Council may be seated when you're ready to proceed. Counsel Fasuma, come forward, state your name if you wish to reserve any time.
We'd like to reserve 5 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Carl Olson. I am local counsel for Appellant Summa Emergency Associates. With me is lead counsel, Jason Wigand, who will argue the matter to the Court.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good morning, counsel.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, there are four main issues in this case and on appeal in this case. A brief overview of those issues. The two primary issues being that the district court misapplied the standard of review when determining the arbitrator's findings and conclusions concerning unconscionability on this contract. Concerning the procedural unconscionability, what the district court did is they went back and they reweighed the evidence versus the appropriate standard of review, which would have been to go back and to look at the record to see if there's substantial evidence to support the arbitrator's findings and conclusions, which was in favor of Summa. Concerning the substantive unconscionability, the district court said that the arbitrator manifestly disregarded the law, and they improperly reached that conclusion concerning the changed circumstances and conditions doctrine in Nevada. The last two issues are on the arbitrator's alternative grounds to support his award, which was not addressed by the district court, and the attorney fee, the improper grant of the attorney fees, which on that issue, unless the court seeks further argument on that, I'll move on from that. So concerning the district courts, actually the arbitrator found in this case both procedural and substantive unconscionability. Actually found two grounds for both. Concerning procedural unconscionability, he found the two ways you can find whether or not there's a contract of adhesion, and whether the other way, which is that the contract terms are not readily ascertainable at the time of contracting. Concerning the first adhesion contract, he finds that this is on a pre-printed form. You've got insurance pros versus doctors. The market at the time was an extremely tight market. You've got doctors' companies going out of business. They need to find an alternative type of to the commercial insurance market. So the arbitrator said this is kind of a take it or leave it product. And that's supported by the actual contract itself, which says the only way to subscribe is to sign the pre-printed forms here, send it in by mail with your money. That's not, so it really didn't matter the party's bargaining position or whether they were commercial entities. There was no opportunity, let alone meaningful opportunity, to negotiate over a term, a pre-printed form, which said this is the only way to subscribe. So there was substantial evidence to support that arbitrator's finding on the adhesion contract. Now, on the second finding, which was that the contract terms were not readily ascertainable at the time of contracting, he found that. He said, well, the contract terms concerning the return of the surplus contribution, the financial impact of that was not readily ascertainable. And yes, while there are warnings, you've got, which was often cited by the other side, you've got warnings that the company may have a financial demise because it had bad losses, or it had a financial demise because of bad investments, whatever that was. We didn't have that here. And there are known restrictions, but one of those restrictions was that was the redemption of the surplus certificates, which the arbitrator ended up determining through his use of extrinsic evidence on what that meant. But what we had was, at the outset, you have this contract which says, okay, everybody's going to pitch in two-thirds of their premium as surplus money, the surplus money being the slush fund or cushion, which provides for operations or losses which are in excess of what the company has for reserves. So you're going to pitch in two-thirds of your premium as a surplus. Everybody's going to be doing that for the foreseeable future. Intent, which is recognized by SUMA's insurance, or I'm sorry, not SUMA's, EPIC's exclusive insurance broker, was that EPIC was going to return the surplus when they reached, when they got sufficient amount, sufficient funds of surplus. But it's not ascertainable, it's not readily ascertainable that what could be envisioned was that EPIC would eliminate the surplus requirement, not just reduce it, which they did have the authority to do, but not just reduce it, eliminate it, and at the same time keep everybody else's money, the old people's money, in order to fund the new people's risk. So those two, that's what that financial impact of how that discretionary return would work was not readily ascertainable. That's the arbitrator's analysis, and there's substantial evidence to support his analysis. What happened at the district court level was the court went back again and reweighed the evidence. They liked the warnings that were cited by EPIC. They liked the evidence that EPIC was citing. But there's evidence on both sides in the case. And they just substituted their judgment for the arbitrator's. When it comes to the substantive unconscionability, the arbitrator found there was substantive unconscionability at the time of contracting and based on this changed circumstances, changed conditions. He said at the time of contracting, what we had it would be substantively unconscionable for SUMA to pay net $460,000 for 5 years of insurance, which is essentially market rate insurance. So that hasn't been questioned. So he found that at the time, and then he also said, even if it's unfair based upon these change conditions. And those change conditions were that EPIC eliminated its fundamental intent and purpose of the surplus, SUMA's surplus contribution, which was to insure for excess, you know, almost corporate apocalypse, if there was a really, really bad year and they needed to dip into funds, the company wouldn't go insolvent. But when SUMA's gone and there's no contingent liability left concerning their insurance or anything, EPIC then takes SUMA's money and uses it to underwrite for New Corp. So now you've got people who are being treated differently, and the benefit that they get is the same. They get to buy this market rate insurance.
Was there something different between the contract that was signed and the brochure that was presented as to a misunderstanding about this redemption of the surplus contributions? Because there was testimony record by Dr. Wright that he'd reviewed the documents and he signed off, and supposedly the understanding, which stated, shall have no right to require the redemption of their surplus contribution certificates in whole or in part under any circumstances.
Right. And then if you finish that sentence, it says other than those described above is the rest of that sentence. So, but turns out there wasn't any described above that required redemption. Right. But it suggests that they were thinking about putting that in there, but apparently it's not there. But then it talks about, and there's many sections.
It indicates he reviewed that, and that's what it stated at the time.
Right, and so we haven't challenged, we actually moved to confirm the arbitrator's finding that there was a discretionary return. We're not disputing that. But what we're, I mean, it turns out, I mean, that's what the arbitrator decided. This is not an absolute right to redeem. It's discretionary. But when you look at the discretionary, he didn't say, well, this is clear. Because, you see, he had to go to extrinsic evidence. I mean, the redemption, discretionary redemption, as it's been interpreted, said at one point it would be discretionary according to the allocation methodologies. EPIC never adopted any allocation methodologies.
Into your 5 minutes you wanted to reserve, sure. But if you have another point you want to make before you sit down, please make it.
Real quickly, I did want to get into the change circumstances, which that it is not expressly prescribed in Nevada, that there is that Corey versus Robinson case, and essentially the arbitrator was applying a frustration of purpose analysis, which I previously went through. Thank you.
Good morning. May I please the court? I'm Brian Anderson on behalf of EPIC, Emergency Physicians Insurance Company Risk Retention Group. The two primary issues that we've been discussing are the grounds to overturn an arbitration award in Nevada, and what are the elements required for unconscionability finding.
And Mr. Anderson, if I could talk about that, you know, when I looked at this case, I thought the key issue is what's the standard of review on reviewing an arbitrator's decision on it. And we know it's more deferential than it is in district court to a trial judge's decision. And counsel just mentioned this Corey case, and I'm going to see what you think of it. They're arguing that even if the arbitrator incorrectly applies the law, it is not a manifest disregard unless he knew how the law should have been applied and consciously ruled differently. That's Corey. Corey says that. Is that the standard in your point of view?
Yes, I do believe that the standard for manifest disregard for the law requires that the arbitrator know the law and then issue a ruling that is in conflict with that law. And I think here, the evidence is in the arbitration award that makes that whole analysis complete. If we want to look at that part specifically, in Bill Stremmel Motors versus IDS Leasing, 1973 case from this court, it was explained that the contract is unconscionable only when the clauses of the contract and the circumstances existing at the time of the execution of the contract are so unsighted as to oppress or unfairly surprise an innocent party. So here, the arbitrator cited the Bill Stremmel case for this proposition. However, the arbitrator disregarded that law and said he's not precluded from consideration of whether a term, e.g., the retention of a large amount of money that was fair at the outset, so he's finding it was fair at the outset, can become unreasonably unfair due to changed circumstances. So, although the terms related to the surplus contributions were fair at the outset of contracting in 2003, the arbitrator concluded it was substantively unfair for EPIC to retain those funds based on circumstances existing as of the arbitration in 2013. Now, part of the history here is that EPIC was the victim of a misappropriation in 2009 and lost a lot of its funds, and at that point, SUMA decided it wanted to withdraw from the RRG. It withdrew in 2009 and in 2010 made a demand on EPIC's board for a refund of its surplus contributions. In its discretion, which the arbitrator has acknowledged has, and under the contracts, the board declined to do that, finding it was not in good financial management. It was not a good sound business decision. And the reasons for that are plentiful. They're even set forth in the arbitration award. It could create a run on the bank situation where any subscriber with surplus contributions could make a same demand for a return of its surplus. And I believe that the arbitrator's language was that it could throw Epic into a death spiral of sorts if it was forced to refund the capital. So if we use the 2009 as our snapshot in time, those circumstances wouldn't require it. And then in 2013, under these new change circumstances, now Epic didn't go out of business and was able to continue to provide insurance for its subscribers. And now the arbitrator is saying, well, now maybe it's unfair for you to keep it now under these circumstances. So Nevada law precludes consideration of fairness of a contract due to changed circumstances. The Ninth Circuit has said whether a contract is fair or works in unconscionable hardship is determined with reference to the time when the contract was made, cannot be resolved by hindsight. So here, the arbitrator appreciated significance of a clearly governing principle, but decided to ignore, pay no attention to that principle. His error is obvious and capable of readily being perceived by an average person qualified to be an arbitrator. The arbitrator appreciated the existence of the legal principle, but ignored it. And this court should affirm the district court's order, finding that that was a manifest disregard for the law. Are there any other questions about the substantive unconscionability portion of the order or the manifest disregard?
No.
If I could just quickly move to the procedural unconscionability section. And basically, at its core, this is a contract dispute. That's written throughout the award by the arbitrator. And the arbitration award confirms that Epic was not liable for fraud, did not breach a fiduciary duty, and acted in good faith in declining SUMA's demand for return of its surplus. The award specifically found that the SUMA-Epic documents make it clear that SUMA has no absolute right to recovery, that Epic has discretion over whether to make any refund, and Epic has exercised that discretion in favor of denying a refund. As a matter of basic contract law, that largely ends the inquiry. And that should have ended the inquiry. The arbitrator acknowledged that deference needs to be given to the board of a highly regulated risk retention group that's already formed under the Federal Liability Risk Retention Act, which allows insureds with similar risks to own their own insurance company. So Epic is comprised of its subscribers or insureds or owners who gave capital surplus at the beginning. That's what they agreed to do. They agreed that these decisions would be made within the discretion of the board, and that the board exercised that discretion, and that discretion was found to be in good faith and should be not re-guessed by the arbitrator, re-guessed by the court. It brings up a kind of a business judgment rule idea where they are the ones that know what they need for surplus under the statute, who they're needing to cover, potential claims, that type of thing. And so when the board acts in good faith and makes that determination, which all those findings are clear in the arbitration award, to second guess that is not the place of an arbitrator or the court. And also, when we go back to procedurally unconscionable, by way of history, Epic began in 2003. At that time, SUMA was an established emergency physician group in Ohio that was looking for insurance. They considered Epic among other insurers. They used an insurance broker, they used an attorney, they reviewed the documents, and it took about a year before that contract was entered. They signed the subscription agreement. After reviewing the information brochure, the surplus agreement, the contribution certificates, all of those documents provide the exact same language about refunding of surplus. And so SUMA entered into that contract knowingly. So generally, procedural unconscionability results from unequal bargaining power, the use of fine print or incomplete or misleading language that fails to inform a reasonable person of its consequences. The lack of procedural unconscionability here is telegraphed by the arbitrator in his own order that he issued earlier, saying that arbitrators are not bound to strictly follow the law. I'm prepared to invoke unconscionability concept if there is sufficient showing of substantive unfairness despite the lack of procedural unconscionability. So in his award, he tries to justify the procedural unconscionability, saying it was contract adhesion essentially, or if it wasn't that, then it wasn't really ascertainable. Now, he's already made a finding that said it was ascertainable, that said you had no right to the money. What else is there to ascertain about it? You, when you're joining this, you do not have a right to get the surplus contributions back. This court has defined an adhesion contract as a standardized contract offered to consumers on a take-it-or-leave-it basis without affording the consumer a realistic opportunity to bargain. The distinctive feature of an adhesion contract is that the weaker party has no choice to its terms. So here, neither party is a consumer. They're both sophisticated parties. Dr. Wright testified that it was likely that Epic benefited from SUMA joining it because of SUMA's experience and because of the surplus contributions. So SUMA took its time. SUMA had other options. They say it was a hard insurance market, but Dr. Wright also testified about the other insurers he was, or SUMA was considering at that time. It's not that Epic was the least expensive one, the only one they could afford, that they were in such a bind that they were forced into this. This has happened over a year's time, and they even testified that, well, when you include the reserve money or the surplus, then Epic was actually on the higher end of the insurers that we were considering. Nevertheless, they elected to join the RRG, they joined Epic, and assented to the terms of the contract knowingly and willfully and with plenty of time to review. So other courts have found that sophisticated parties are not even entitled to invoke the defense of unconscionability. I'm not sure that that has been found here, but the emphasis on the consumer, the weaker party, not having an opportunity to negotiate is a part of it, and that the weaker party might not understand what's going on. Those aren't the elements that are here for a contract of adhesion.
Can you talk about the costs and attorney's fees issue?
Yes. Okay, so when the arbitration award came out, it found in favor of Epic on nearly every claim, but then there was the unconscionability ruling that resulted in a monetary judgment in favor of SUMA. This court has said a party prevails if it succeeds on any significant issue in litigation which achieves some benefit it sought in bringing the suit. So we moved, Epic moved, filed the petition under NRS 38, which provides that upon application, a prevailing party to a contested judicial proceeding under 38239, that the court may add reasonable attorney's fees and other reasonable expenses of litigation incurred in a judicial proceeding. So the petition to the district court was a judicial proceeding. We filed a petition to confirm in part and vacate in part. SUMA's response was that it moved to affirm the order in its entirety. So what's at stake there is the entire monetary judgment. If the arbitration award is overturned, then Epic is the prevailing party. That's the primary issue that was being considered by the district court. So the district court matter was a contested judicial proceeding as each party requested the separate relief. And so, therefore, the district court's award of attorney's fees was proper under the statute. The Brunzell factors, a subsequent motion for attorney's fees, all of those things were also considered by the court. So the amount of the attorney's fees and the propriety of the attorney's fees were both proper.
SUMA didn't contest the confirmation of the award, did it?
SUMA instrument. Well, they certainly oppose our petition to vacate the award, vacate in part.
Okay, and did you prevail on common law grounds or statutory grounds on that issue?
Well, I believe that because the arbitration statute provides for the prevailing party in a contested judicial proceeding, that the statutory grounds were the grounds that provided us our right to attorney's fees.
Okay. So it's your position you can get costs and attorney's fees both?
For the district court level proceeding.
Okay.
Unless there are any further questions? Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. Just a couple of things. Justice Gibbons brought up a good point on the manifest disregard. I don't believe there was any contrary evidence to the Corey versus Robinson case. We don't dispute Bill Strimmel. Arbitrator acknowledged Bill Strimmel exists. Ordinarily, at the time of contracting, that is true, that it has to be assessed there. And in fact, the arbitrator did find it at the time of contracting. And then he also said, if it's not, there's this changed circumstances, which is recognized in Nevada. So I don't see Bill Strimmel as absolutely prescribing the changed circumstances doctrine. Now, what's very interesting is that the district court decision, when it goes to find the manifest disregard of by the arbitrator, it cites the arbitrator's decision, and what you find, it actually, there's a block quote, and what's taken out is the arbitrator's reasoning for why he thinks, the example, the basis for why he's not manifesting disregarding the law, and they replace it with an ellipse, which that was the exact reason for him. It's not that he knew the law required a particular result. He went through a long explanation of why he thought this was appropriate to use. Next on, I think today Epic is proving my point. For a large portion of their case presented is their own evidence. That's not the standard of review. We're supposed to look, is there evidence in the record under arbitrary and capricious? Is there substantial evidence in the record to support the arbitrator's findings and conclusions? So was there evidence in favor of Sumo? We're not here to reweigh the evidence again.
You want to talk about the costs and attorney's fees? Mr.
Sure.
Anderson set forth his position, why he feels they're proper.
Right.
Can you comment on that?
Thank you. The attorney fees cannot be awarded without the statutory right to do so. The statute does not provide any basis to award attorney fees for common law grounds. The only statutory abilities to overturn the decision were not used in this case. And when the district court entered its order, it said that was why they were based on Epic's petition. But Epic's petition, the district court says, we're giving attorney fees based upon Epic's petition, which that petition is entirely a common law grounds, arbitrary and capricious, manifest disregard. No improper conduct against the arbitrator or any of the statutory enumerated basis to overturn an arbitrator's award.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you very much.
Okay.
Thank you both counsel for their arguments this day. This matter will stand submitted.